Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Thea. For this episode, I'm joined by Michael Farmer to speak about his latest book, Madison Avenue Makeover, and the transformation of the ad agency business. Prior to founding Farmer & Company in 1992, Michael Farmer was a strategy consultant with the Boston Consulting Group and the director of Bain & Company. He headed Bain's Munich, Paris, and London offices during Bain's decade of European expansion in the 1980s. He is the author of Madison Avenue Manslaughter. His new book, Madison Avenue Makeover, tells the riveting story of the global digital agency Huge and its journey through its transformation effort. It also provides a unique insight into how one company changed in order to survive and, at the same time, redefined the advertising agency business. Thank you very much, Michael, for joining us today on Lit Radio Podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your latest book, Madison Avenue Makeover. And my very first question to you is, could you tell us the story of how the idea of writing that book came up?
Oh, very, very good question. Well, actually, the idea of the book came from Matt Baxter, the chief executive of Huge, who had been on the job for probably a little bit over a month back in 2021. He had previously read Madison Avenue Manslaughter, my first book, that had its most recent third edition came out in 2019. He had read the book and he understood many of the problems that I talked about in the creative industry. And here was Matt, who had been a 20-year veteran of running media agencies, going to his first creative agency, Huge, owned by Interpublic Group. Matt would be leaving Initiative, the media agency owned by IPG, and had a creative agency for the first time. And he wasn't really quite sure what to do. He'd read the book, he understood the problems and everything. So what he first called me about in August, no, I think it was July, July of 2021, about a month after he took over, he said, "I need a big idea for the transformation, which I am absolutely committed to make. And I wonder if this wouldn't be a great opportunity for you to write a book at the same time." So he was really then looking for two things: a big transformation idea and a book. And I thought that that was a mission impossible. I didn't see how I could both consult to them and write a book about the consulting afterwards. But fortunately, that solved itself because separately, Mark Manning, who is his chief operating officer, and Matt decided to hire a different consulting firm called the Business Model Company. And they provided the big transformation idea that began in 2021. And I got to write an independent book about it. In fact, one of the things that I insisted is if I write this book as a fly on the wall, you've got to let me write what I need to write. I can't be writing this with you looking over my shoulder editorially. So, Matt said, that's great, because listen, I want you to write about the good, the bad, and the ugly of what we're doing. Well, there was a lot of good, and there wasn't very much bad, and there certainly wasn't very much ugly, but there is a lot of complication in the transformation of Huge. Anyway, I set out to interview everyone and to participate in all the management meetings, you know, for the next year and a half. And then about a year after this thing kicked off, I actually started drafting the book in July of last year, and it took about 4 months to write. Went to the publisher, and we've been doing editing ever since.
Yeah, amazing. I think it's a very brave move from a CEO.
Well, I think too, when you want to do a transformation, and you're not sure what you want to do, and at the same time, you're hiring an industry critic to write a book about it, that sounds risky to me. And I told Matt at the time that I was thrilled with the possibility, absolutely, because I had been waiting 30 years in my consulting career for a chief executive to take on this very problem. And he was the first. So, of course, I was excited about it, and even more excited that I could write what I wanted without any interference. But it was a brave and extremely risky move on his part to commission a book at a time when he wasn't sure what he was going to do, and to give me complete independence. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is a very brave and risky move. And I don't think you can see that very often, if at all, actually. So yeah, it's a great story.
That's why I think, and I hope that the book is worth reading for those, because it describes a very complicated transformation in all of its dimensions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great read. I can confirm that. But before we deep dive into the transformation of Huge, let's talk a little bit about your first book, Madison Avenue Manslaughter, which you mentioned a few minutes ago. So in that book, you speak about issues of the advertising industry. So could you tell us what are some of the most serious issues that this field is still facing? And have you seen any improvements since you wrote that book?
Oh, fine. Very, very good question. Well, bear in mind that I'm more a management consultant than a book author. And I have been working as a consultant to help ad agencies and their clients for the last 30 years. This Farmer and Company focus on advertising began in 1992 with an agency that came to me quite by accident. And I studied it. So everything I know about the industry, I have learned by discovering the problems that my clients had. And I was a little frustrated, I think, you know, around 2010 or so. By that time, I'd been working 20 years and I kept seeing the same problems. So I set out to write a book about my experience and what I had found called Madison Avenue Manslaughter. It came out in 2015 with a revised edition in 17 and 19. And listen, the problems haven't changed. If anything, they're worse today than they were when I started, because they're headed on the same trajectory. So I think there are five things that I would identify as the key problems. The first one is the business model. The agencies as a business, it's highly flawed. And it has to do with the way they're paid. After a long period of time in which agencies were paid on commission, meaning they got a share of whatever the client spent on media, they got a 15% commission. It shifted in the 90s and 2000s and afterwards to where they're now paid for the people that account, not for the work that the people do. And over the last 20 years or so, that work has been growing because of digital and social advertising. So work is growing. The fees for the people have been declining. And work is not measured or negotiated. So agencies are seeing declining fees and growing workloads. And as a result of that, the people are under enormous pressure to do the work. So that business model is totally flawed. And as long as they don't measure the amount of work they do and use it for negotiation purposes, they're going to be at a disadvantage with their clients, because procurement's just going to say, we can't afford $2 million this year. We're going to pay you $1.5 million next year. No one says, well, for how much work? Because work is not negotiated or measured. That's a big problem. The second problem, I think, is the business concept of agencies is invalid. The business concept is based on a premise that if agencies are creative and they focus on creativity, that creativity is assumed to deliver improved results, marketing results for clients, just as it did 50 years ago, when creativity became the religion that was worshipped by ad agencies. Now, if you actually measure the performance of advertisers in recent decades, they have not grown. And despite the fact that they've made massive investments in digital, in social media, with, you know, Facebook, or Meta as it's called today, and Google and search and so forth and so on, they've made massive investments, but they haven't gotten a return for it. Yet, agencies continue to say that creativity is what we're all about, and they assume creativity delivers results. It doesn't do that. So that is a very, very big problem that agencies have. It hasn't delivered improved performance for the last 15 years, and the industry needs a new mission. So that's part of what we wrote about in Madison Avenue Makeover, was the new mission that Huge adopted, which was improved results for clients, or accelerated growth for clients. I'd say the third problem is that partnerships have eroded between agencies and their clients. They've really eroded to become vendorships. And by that, I mean that the client hires the agency that can do the work, and they try to get it for the lowest cost. And if, you know, as soon as they think they can get better costs from someone else, they're likely to shift. Relationships only last about 3 years today. They used to last 20. Today, it's about three. And what's happened is that agencies now deliver service, in other words, whatever the client wants, at low price. Well, clients really need more than that, but they're not asking for it. What clients really need is more growth, more profitability, better market shares, better brand performance all the way around. And they haven't gotten it for quite some time. So as a result, clients have said, well, if we're not going to get profits from growth, we're going to get profits from cost reduction. And that's why they've been taking agency fees down. Agencies need more than low cost. They need growth, but they don't actually trust their agency partners and don't trust their capabilities. Well, why should they? Agencies have had to downsize every year with the lower fees. And so there's been a pretty big talent drain, which is another one of the problems that I'd like to identify. Now, the holding companies that own most of the big agencies are also part of the problem, and they make things worse by forcing agencies to downsize to make their profit numbers every year. And as fees have gone down, and agencies are paid for the number of people they have, well, if fees go down, then the number of people has to go down. At least that's been the reasoning. And so as holding companies have forced agencies to downsize every year to make their numbers, agencies have seen a talent liquidation. So, I mean, that is really a very large problem. So we have a business model issue, that's pricing. We've got a business concept issue around creativity and its purposes. We have vendorship relationships that need to be turned into partnership, and we've seen talent liquidation. Agencies are worse off today than ever before because, as far as I can tell, Matt Baxter and Huge are the only agency to confront these problems and deal with them. And they are not a huge agency. They're huge, but they're not huge in size. They're an important part of IPG, but they're not as big as some of the other agencies that they compete with.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for sharing those insights. It's interesting to see how not much, if anything at all, has changed since you've written your first book.
It's headed for a disaster, but we'll talk about that maybe a little later in this recording.
Yeah, we will. But let's speak now about Huge and their journey. So could you tell us how their paradigm shift started?
Yes, I use the term paradigm shift in the book in an important way. And it's a concept that I stole from a writer who wrote about the history of science and talked about how it is science changes as different data are developed. And he talks about paradigm shift in science. And I used the concept in the advertising industry to talk about Huge's shift from talking about its creativity and its service orientation to shifting to become a partner with future clients to improve their growth rates, to help them accelerate their growth rates. That's the paradigm change of Huge. Now, I might have invented the concept, the idea of paradigm change in advertising for the book, but you have to recognize Matt Baxter, who's only 45 years old today, has for the last 25 years been someone who questioned the status quo. You know, when he left university in Australia and decided that he had had enough of marketing and he'd had enough of his legal studies, he went to Zenith, a media agency, in 1998. And there, as a young kid, he was 20 years old or so, he was absolutely appalled at what they showed as a lack of media neutrality. He felt that a media agency should help the clients, you know, plan and buy media in the area of media that's right for the clients. What he found at Zenith, or at least he says he found at Zenith, was a bias for the account people to sell TV advertising instead of any type of advertising. Media neutrality would have said, hey, I think radio is better than TV, or I think digital is better if, you know, had it existed then. So he was very much of a bomb thrower in his early days. And then he moved on to Naked, where he became a partner in Australia. And Naked openly promoted media neutrality. He then went on to Mediacom Australia, UM Australia, and Initiative, the media agency in New York, where he turned it around. In every one of those cases, Matt shook things up. He was always looking for something different to do because he just never accepts the status quo. And if he walked into a creative agency and they told him, this is how we do things, he would probably think, yeah, that's probably wrong. I wonder what needs to be done. And so his personality is very important. Furthermore, I'll take a little tiny bit of credit in that while he was at Initiative, he read Madison Avenue Manslaughter, and he had a view of all the things that we just talked about, you know, for your previous questions. Also, he noted the success of management consultants in their industry. You know, and consultants, that industry has done nothing but grow for 40 years. And consultants are paid by their clients more than three times as much as ad agency people are paid. Why? Baxter said, well, you know, they focus on helping clients perform better. And if they help clients perform better and they succeed, there's a lot more money in that than in telling clients you're creative and you win awards. So he sort of put this all together. And when he conducted his first management retreat at Huge in October 2021, that I wrote about in the book, he raised questions about what does it take to be a great company? What is it about them? And in the 3 days that they had their retreat, he and his management team, who he was working with for the first time, came to believe that the right mission for Huge was to help clients accelerate growth. That's what they really needed. That's what they weren't getting from any agencies today. And Huge felt it was within its capability to provide that, mission. So that's how the shift took place. And then when they brought on the business model company as their consulting firm, and they followed their playbook, they just took the paradigm shift and they turned it into operational matters like changing the pricing, changing the organization, changing the training, and, you know, changing the way they approach clients. So that's how the paradigm shift happened, but it will be an ongoing thing because every time they talk to a client, they're talking the new paradigm, which is Huge, is all about helping clients accelerate their growth.
Yeah, definitely. And that's all amazing, but a transformation is a very long and difficult process. So could you share with us what are some of the obstacles that Huge had to overcome along the way?
Well, okay, that's interesting because here's Matt Baxter, Australian citizen who had been working in the States for 5 years in media and had 100% media background, taking over a creative agency that had four previous chief executives in 4 years. Why? They weren't growing. They weren't all that profitable. And Interpublic Group that owned them wasn't all that happy. So they took Matt, who was a successful young chief executive in media, and said, how about a new challenge? How about taking over Huge? And then he had to figure out what all of Huge's problems were and develop an action plan. But, you know, basically, here's what he found. First of all, Huge had about 180 clients that were operating on the old model. He had a new idea about where they would go, but it probably would not be with these clients. On the other hand, these clients were providing all of the sales and profits that nourished Huge and its employees and Interpublic, who owned them. So you could say 100% of the sales and profits came from a business that Matt wanted to change. And, you know, he couldn't just stop everything and say, all right, forget about it. We're going to start over. He had to live with 180 clients, try to convert some of them, try to get rid of some of them, and try to develop new clients on the new model. So that was clearly an obstacle. The other thing, and there were many others, but Huge was a fragmented company. It had 12 offices around the world, and every one of them had its own strategy for talking to clients, had its own training, had its own client, you know, office president, et cetera. And what Matt needed to do was to create a single culture around what was 12 cultures. So he had to discover what each of the offices were actually like and think about whether he could continue to work with them as offices or whether he needed to abandon the concept that this was an office-based culture and create a single global organization, which, by the way, is what he actually did. And I wrote about that in the book. He had about 1,500 people in the organization who knew only how to work the old way. So he had to both convince them that there was a better way, although it was a way they didn't know, and that they would be okay at doing it. They needn't worry about their job tenure. You know, Matt said in one all-hands meeting, look, we're doing something new and none of us know how to do it. So don't feel like you're going to be left out. We're all going to have to step up to the plate and do things in a different way. Those people were running projects rather than selling products. And the new organization was going to go towards product rather than project. And so people needed retraining, and they also needed, Huge as an organization, needed to develop the products that were going to be sold. The 20 people who represented his top management team were inexperienced working with each other. Each of them had helped the offices in their own way over time, but it would have been wrong to assume that this was a top management group that ever met as a top management group to figure out where the company was going. Matt brought them together for that mission for the first time. And he didn't know what they would be like as a group. He had never actually, he didn't know them as individuals. He got to know them, but it was in the middle of COVID. It was really hard to meet directly. So when he had his first retreat in October, which was what, July, August, September, October, 4 months on board, that he was getting them together as a group to see how they would work. So that was a formidable obstacle. All of those, the client base, the need to generate profits and sales every year, the fragmented culture, the 1,500 people that needed retraining and an experienced top management group. That was a lot. And I think if he had known all that, maybe he would have waited a little bit, but he just plunged ahead and figured out that once he discovered the problems, he'd find a fix for it. That's what he had always done in his past. And he's quite a brave chief executive.
Yeah, he is. Those are some big obstacles he needed to overcome. But yeah, so talking about the transformation, this is still ongoing. This is not a finished project yet. But how would you describe that paradigm shift that Huge went through? And what are the most important warnings from it?
Okay, that's a very good question, Taya. What really was this paradigm shift and the important learnings? Because it wasn't just saying, oh, we're going to have a different mission. Now we're going to help clients grow. There were all the little details that went with it. But ultimately, the mission of Huge is to help clients accelerate their growth. That's why we exist, he's going to say to new clients. We want to be working in relationships where that is the shared goal. And if you're looking for something different, if you just want someone to execute for you, to do the work that you want done at low price, you know, there are people that'll do that. It isn't us. So we're not interested in that anymore. We have a focus. Now, within the paradigm shift, there were a number of things that would go with it. That creativity is part of it. That Huge has over 350 creatives today. And, you know, the creativities will still be creative, but it is going to be creativity with a purpose. We're going to use our creative capability to develop ideas that will help clients grow. And in addition, we have to marry that with our technology people, because we do websites and we get involved in e-commerce. We use our technology in important ways. It's very important that we bring to bear our strategists and our analysts who can look at client data to figure out where the problems are and what kind of work, what kind of products are required. But creativity isn't the end in itself, as it is for many agencies. So one of the important learnings is creativity needs to work in collaboration with technology, with strategy, and with analysis. It is not it's not an empire on its own, as it is at many agencies. And the creative director is an important person, along with the technology director, the strategy director, the analysis director, the head of studio, and other things of that sort. In addition, one of the important learnings is you do have to have the kind of relationship with the right level of executive in order to pull this off. You can't just work for some low-level marketing person that wants work done. You really have to work for the chief marketing officer, if not the chief executive officer, if you're going to be involved in a partnership that involves a focus on improved results. So the relationship that has improved results as a purpose is a learning. That's something that they have to do. And then on top of that, the client needs to share with Huge and with any agency that goes down this route, what are the problems that need to be solved? What are the barriers to growth that we've encountered? And, you know, the funny thing is clients don't share that kind of stuff with their agencies. They say, here's the work we want done. What's your bid? As opposed to, here are the six performance problems that are driving us crazy. Can you figure out with us how to solve them? Ironically, that's not how the industry works, but Huge is going to make it work that way for itself. And then finally, it needs a very different type of relationship manager or client partner, as they call them at Huge. The people that run these accounts for the client, they have to be 100% focused on, is our work helping you grow? Are we doing the right work? Is this relationship functioning in a streamlined way so that we can do that for you? What are the things that are getting in the way of that? How can we fix them? That's a very different role for client partners than saying, yes, sir, you need this work done. We can do it, and because we have all the capabilities. That's not what Huge requires. So that's certainly the important learnings. Have a lot to do with relationship, the use of creativity relative to the other crafts within Huge, the nature of the relationship itself and who they work for, and what the client partners have to bring to the party in order to manage this to success.
Thank you for sharing those warnings. I'm sure they will be very useful for anyone working in an ad agency listening to us today. And then just going back to creativity, because in the book, and we already covered this a little bit, but in the book, you argue that creativity is not the most important asset for an ad agency. So why do you think so? And what do you think is the most important asset?
First of all, let me tell you, I hate to use the word creativity for anything. What does it mean? And How can any big agency that has thousands of people declare we're the most creative agency, or we're the creative agency of the year, or a holding company is the holding company of the year because it's the most creative, it won the most clients or something of that? It's crazy. You know, I was for nearly 25 years a senior executive at Bain & Company, and before that, the Boston Consulting Group. So, and, you know, I've done Farmer & Company for over 30 years. So I have a long history as a consultant. What do consultants do? They analyze. But we don't talk about, I'm Michael Farmer from Bain & Company, we're analytical. That's not what you say. What you say is, we really, during the Bain speech, we deliver improved performance to clients. It's about what we do, not what we are. And I don't understand the words creativity or analysis at all. And I hate to use them. And the agency world talks about creativity like it's something you can pick up off a shelf. You can hire to get more creativity. You can train to be more creative. You can make speeches and have parties and win awards and celebrate your creativity. And it's something you can do something about. That's just wrong. Creativity is a capability that some people have within creative departments. But it isn't everything, and it cannot be an end in itself, which it is for the industry. That's how it gets itself into pricing problems. I have heard more agencies tell me, you know, we're not making any money on this account, but it's a great creative opportunity, meaning we can do the kind of ads that might win awards. That's nuts. So creativity is not the most important asset. No, it is a very important asset. You cannot exist without being creative. You can't exist without being analytical. You can't exist without being problem solving. You can't exist without the right kind of relationships and the right kind of fees and the right kind of people that are paid the right amount of money. Creativity is not above any of those things. And for me, it's merely a capability like being analytical. So creativity and analysis are meaningless words, but they are absolutely essential as capabilities. What matters is what you do with your creativity and your analytical capability and your problem-solving ability and what you do with the fees that you're paid and the costs that you pay out, not simply that it exists. And by the way, after 30 years of consulting to this industry, this is the biggest thing I'm up against. Because I tell people, you need to measure how much work you're doing. You need to negotiate how much work you're doing for the fees that you are to be paid. And they say, well, Michael, you know, listen, you know, you can't really measure creativity. I mean, how can you measure a big idea? How can you measure how much time it takes? And it gets in the way of being analytical about their own business or being sensible about their own business. So creativity, I just wish people would stop talking about it. And the Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity that I'm going to go to in June to launch my book is a big perpetrator of the myth that creativity should be celebrated as a capability and given awards to agencies that they can tout. I think it's a big mistake. There is no festival of analysis for management consulting firms. And let me tell you one thing. Management consulting firms are much more successful than ad agencies, and they don't have a festival of analysis. So I don't think agencies should have a festival of creativity and use it the same way. No, I'm being a little facetious. I think the festival's great and it's fun, but what matters is what you do with creativity, not the fact that it exists.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point of view. Thanks for sharing.
It makes me look like a Neanderthal when I'm talking to creatives. But the funny thing is, creatives agree with this. They think the creatives in most agencies think that the work should be more business focused. And they hate the fact that the agency will just take on anything because the client wants it. They think there should be some pushback. I get more support from the creatives on this than I get from the people that should be doing it. So, you know, I don't want to give you the impression that I'm anti-creative and I don't think creativity matters. Creativity matters in management consulting too. You know, the greatest ideas are creative ideas that came out of the, you know, right side of someone's brain. It's necessary. But I hate to see creativity made a religion of, because I don't even know what it really is, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And then after discussing huge transformation in creativity, and some of the issues that the advertising industry is facing, how do you see the future of advertising?
Well, you know, if you think about the problems I went through, clients are cutting fees. Agencies are downsizing and eliminating their talent as a result. Workloads are growing, and clients are underperforming. That encourages clients to keep shopping for agencies, thinking that if they change agencies, they can both get lower cost and maybe better creativity. Who knows? But if you just take those trends that I outlined in Madison Avenue Manslaughter, that's industry that based on the pricing, the way it's going and the business model, et cetera, is headed to disaster. It's going to be a train wreck. I don't know when, but at some point, the holding companies are not going to be able to make their earnings targets. And Wall Street's going to get upset with them saying, what's going on here? I thought, you know, if you own all of these incredible properties, you own creative agencies, media agencies, consulting firms, data providers, public relations firms, production houses, all of that. And I'm missing out a lot of what they own. What happens if the holding companies can no longer deliver the profit? So in Madison Avenue Manslaughter, I said, this is going to head to a train wreck. I just don't know when. But at some point, holding companies are going to fail to deliver what Wall Street's looking for, and Wall Street will abandon them and force a breakup. In other words, the parts are worth more than the whole. That's what I wrote then. Okay, that was before AI. And if you think about the effect of artificial intelligence, which I use now, and I play with enormously, and I see many examples of great AI. AI is going to decimate the creation of many types of advertising deliverables. Now, I've said that workloads grow, but almost all of the digital and social deliverables that agencies do today can be done by machine, can be done by good AI programs. And it will decimate creative departments to the extent to which creative departments are, you know, doing that kind of work, which they do today. Now, why will it decimate them? Because it'll get rid of people, and agencies are paid for people, not for work. So if all of a sudden, you know, there are 50 people working on a client account and AI takes out 15 or 20 of those people, which is possible, then by today's pricing standard, agencies will lose, you know, 20% of their fee because they're no longer people doing the work. If, on the other hand, agencies were paid for the work they do, they'd be protected. Yes, since agencies are paid by head and not for the work, then this new technology, this AI technology in all of its forms, attacks the way agencies are paid and will force a reduction in how much they're paid. And that will kill the holding companies. It'll kill the agency themselves. And unless the holding companies and the agencies do a huge type transformation that says we're going to be paid for the work we do, the products we sell, not the people who are required to do it, that transformation must begin now. Otherwise, AI is going to decimate the industry faster than all the other factors that I wrote about in Madison Avenue Manslaughter. So the survivors now in the industry, there will be survivors. I think Huge will be a great survivor because I don't think they can be affected by AI. They're selling products at a fixed cost and they're focused on delivering results. If they succeed at that, they will be a survivor. The other survivors will be those agencies and holding companies who shift to being paid for the work, and who end up with senior people not replaced by AI, who become kind of a brain trust for their clients. In other words, if a lot of the busy work goes to AI, it leaves the non-busy thinkers and strategists and analysts and creatives who can actually work on the top level client problems that cannot be solved by AI. So in a funny way, AI, if looked at properly, could accelerate the type of transformation that Matt Baxter is leading at Huge, which is to say we want to help clients perform better. Well, if AI takes away all the busy work and it leaves the thinkers, then new types of relationships are required in which the thinkers are more important than they are perceived to be today. So the future of advertising, I think, rests on, number one, how the current players deal with the threat of AI and whether they transform themselves to be paid for work that's done rather than the number of people required to do it. And if they take advantage of that to recreate their relationships so that those relationships become let's solve performance problems instead of let's do a lot of fun stuff creatively. So that's what I hope will be the case. And I hope that the readers of Madison Avenue Makeover take away from it that it's more than a story about Huge. It's more than a story about Matt Baxter's leadership. It's more than a story about how one agency among all the agencies in the industry, how one agency is trying to do something different. It actually almost provides a template for the direction that everyone else could go in order to deal with the AI threat and the pricing threat and the vendorship threat that agencies currently have today. So I wish I had had more exposure to AI when I was writing the book, but it didn't come up. And I don't even think the word artificial intelligence is mentioned in the book, even though the book was done, you know, basically written at the end of 2022 for publication now in June 2023. However, it's obvious that AI is going to have a dramatic impact on the creation of deliverables and needs to be viewed as the major threat for which a Huge type transformation is the answer. So I'm actually hopeful about the future of advertising because I'm an optimist forever. And I think that people should learn what they can learn from people that are doing the right things. Baxter and Huge are doing the right thing. And I think Madison Avenue Makeover describes in an accurate way and in an empathetic way what they had to go through to get there. So it's a fair book that someone else could use as a guide for turning around, you know, current agencies or even holding companies.
Yeah, definitely. And it's very interesting to hear how AI may be a huge threat, because everybody has been talking about AI, especially since ChatGPT came around. So it's really showing the huge impact it might have in all different industries. And then lastly, my very last question for you would be for any ad agencies, employees and leaders listening to us today. So what's your advice to them, to those agencies that are seeking to improve their business models and ways of working? What are the most critical factors for the paradigm shift to be successful?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to have the right leader. And you know, employees can't do anything about that. There is a real, I think, a dearth of leadership in the industry. I think the industry has gotten very good at making its numbers for its annual budgets. I think CEOs have become adept at working in the holding company environment and dealing with the extraordinary changes that have taken place in media, you know, over the last 20 years or so. I think agency CEOs have adjusted their organizations to handle more complexity. And they've also, as I mentioned, dealt with making their numbers in the face of the increased complexity of their operations. But what they haven't done is to think about the bigger problem that they need to solve, which is has to do with the relationships and the pricing and all that other stuff. So we need extraordinary leaders who are, they're more risk, who need to be risk takers. And why risk takers? Because when you do what Matt Baxter did, there was no guarantee of success in anything that he did during the transformation's 18 months. He was putting huge at risk by saying, we're going to abandon the old way of doing business and adopt a new and untested way of doing business. That's a risk, but it should have a big reward. Most CEOs today are leading their organizations in a zero risk way. They're just saying, we'll make our numbers. That's what we have to do. And they know darn well that if they have difficulty making their numbers, they just fire people. They reduce their costs. So I think most agencies can make their numbers. That isn't a very risky thing to do, except for the long term. What they're not doing is taking the risk of changing the business model in a different way. Okay, that's for the leaders. Now, what about the top management and the people in the organization? I would say the same thing is true for them as it is for my students. You know, I teach at City College part-time to graduate students that are in the industry and want viable careers. They look at all the everything that's going on and they think, oh my God, is there a career in this for me? And what I try to encourage them is to be optimistic. There isn't an industry today that isn't going through massive change. You think about the petroleum fuels, you think of automotive industry, you think about all the businesses that rely on petrol-driven cars, when petrol-driven cars are going to become a declining percentage of total automobiles. You think about climate change, you think about oceans rising, you think about the agricultural business, the water business. There isn't any, the electricity business, there isn't anything that isn't going to change. And advertising industry is just one of the many industries that faces enormous change. So I tell my students, hey, listen, there is no safe haven anymore. You have to be part of the solution. You have to be part of the problem solving. You have to bring your energy in positive and optimistic ways rather than, oh my God, how are we going to do this? You know? And what we need is optimism, belief that a positive future can be created despite the complexity and the chaos. You have to have faith. You can't be a pessimist. And you have to bring your energy to your organizations in the right way. Now, I would encourage employees to be more outspoken rather than saluting and saying, yes, sir. I think employees need to be made aware of all the complexity of their operations and for their top management to mobilize their creativity and their analytical instincts and their strategic instincts to create a better organization. So I think the future requires optimism and a belief that problems can be solved. And I think it goes from the very top, from the chief executives who need to embrace risk, all the way down to employees who need to live in the midst of risk. And I think if that happens, this can once again be a thriving, profitable, respectable industry instead of the sweatshop that it's turned out, you know, in so many quarters.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for sharing those tips. I hope they will be useful for those listening to us today. And thanks very much, Michael, for the time spent today answering my questions. I think it was a very insightful conversation. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Taya. And I certainly enjoyed doing this book. It's a lot more fun to write about something positive that's going on in the face of problems than to just write a book that's focused on all the problems. So it was a very healthy thing for me to move into Madison Avenue makeover phase, And I hope that listeners will buy and read the book and let me know what they think about it. And if they're in the agency business, to be inspired by what Matt Baxter and the management team at Huge have taken on and are planning for their future.
Definitely. I would absolutely recommend buying and reading the book. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lead Publishing on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and at Lead Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. We are now also on TikTok, so make sure you follow us at Lead Publishing. See you next time on Lead Radio Podcast.